Hello and welcome to the Engagement Coach Podcast.
Welcome to the Engagement Coach Podcast with your host, Amrit Sander. So the theme of this week's podcast is evidence-based decision-making and evidence-based practice. We've heard a long time now, L&D needs to be, you know, there needs to be a clear return on investment. There needs to be evidence of the impact it's had. We see it in employee engagement. You know, it's not causation, it's correlation. And how do we go about getting evidence and making robust decisions in environments that aren't laboratories? These aren't controlled environments where we have variables that we can tinker with. We're dealing with multiple variables across organizations. So how do we go about making evidence-based decisions? And to help me with this, I've got Dr. Thomas Evans joining me. He's an associate professor in occupational psychology at Coventry University. So Tom, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So Tom, before we dive into understanding more about your speciality and an area that I'm really interested in, it'll be really good to know you, your background and your experience.
So I'm currently an associate professor in occupational psychology at Coventry University, and my experience thus far is predominantly around applied research and looking at things like evidence quality and looking at how that can be used to inform evidence-based practice.
So the reason why I'm really fascinated with this is one of the things that when I started to do I got into the employee engagement space, and one of my biggest frustrations were with engagement surveys, how do you know they're the right questions and you know, looking for evidence and what have you. And one of the things I've realized, both in learning and development and employee engagement, there's a big issue in evidence and return on investment and being able to demonstrate. And one of the frustrations I've had has been where people will say, well, hang on, it's got to be evidence-based. And yet we in the world of work, we've got so many variables and a lack of control. This is not a laboratory. How do we go about creating as good as a test to check to see whether we've got evidence for? I mean, how would somebody go about doing that? I mean, I guess all the work you do is strictly in a laboratory where you can control the controllable.
Yeah, I mean, it's, for me, evidence practice is about judicious use of a variety of different sources. So that can mean academic works, but that can also mean anecdotal evidence. And I guess it's about being critical about all those different types of sources of evidence and breaking down and saying, what is the best thing I can do with that? So it's sometimes known as satisficing in terms of decision making. What's the best thing I can do with this amount of information I've got, without trying to collect more and more data and more information until I hopefully know as much as I can do? What can I do right now, which is the best route with what I've got? And I think sometimes it just comes down to that we as practitioners sometimes can't know everything and can't know what the right thing to do, especially when things are so uncertain. And so for me, it's about doing the best with what evidence we can collect and accepting the variety of strengths and weaknesses associated with them all.
And one of the things in employee engagement, one of the things that it used to be the kryptonite, and I think it probably still is, the kryptonite of employee engagement is it's correlation, not causation. And that used to then just dissolve the argument and used to scroll away thinking, that's it, I've got no case here. Have you come across that sort of thing?
Absolutely everywhere. Correlation doesn't actually really tell us anything. So there's a great website called Spurious Correlations, and it will show you things like the number of Nicolas Cage films per year and deaths per year via drowning. Do these things actually relate? No. Do they mean anything? Probably not. That doesn't necessarily mean it doesn't, but in so many cases, it's very easy to use things that are poor quality evidence, things like correlational studies or case study designs, where we look at one organization, see what we can get from that in terms of before and after, and make some grand conclusions about, for example, how great our intervention was. And to be honest, that sort of evidence just doesn't stack up.
So if we've got situations such as learning and development, I mean, there's an awful lot, again, of learning and development, where organizations are being encouraged to demonstrate return on investment. And if we can't demonstrate that, then clearly it's not worthy of investing in. Again, one of my biggest frustrations with this area is that the variables are, there's so many. Firstly, the quality of the training, the how I was feeling on the day, whether I choose to then do something with that or not. when you're looking at those sort of, how would somebody go about at least trying to find evidence to say whatever intervention we've put in place has led to something of value? Where would you start?
I mean, that's so difficult. For me, I'm with you. Don't go based on return on investment alone. That in of itself kind of puts any sort of evaluation into a box as to did it do something or did it not? Is it meeting such targets? But it's impossible to know whether what you did contributed to that financial benefit or not. What we don't understand in so many contexts and so many different ways is what ways do these interventions work? What are the pathways by which you do this thing and it leads to financial outcomes, which are great? And often it's always looking at that, oh, well, did it make X amount of money that we wanted it to? And that just doesn't actually summarize fairly how useful that intervention was to the organization. And so I would say you have to then take a step back and look at a couple of different levels. So not just the traditional way of evaluating training, which is asking people afterwards, what did you think? Or, you know, a day after, do you remember what we said to you? But perhaps looking at whether there are any long-term meaningful behavioral changes, whether there's any long-term kind of cultural changes, and looking at something that's far more sustainable in terms of long-term impact. And so it's kind of don't focus on the bottom where it's just taking their word for it, and don't take it at the top going, does it make me enough money? But look somewhere in the middle of, does it look to be producing the behaviours in our employees that we want it to? And I guess for me, that would be where the value would be if you can articulate really specifically what you want those interventions to achieve somewhere in that middle level. And obviously, it's okay to also get some sense of whether people were upset or enjoyed your training or if it did lead to kind of financial inputs. But that middle ground is where you're going to get the most useful information. And that is the kind of information that you could use for future interventions and would be really useful to know as the kind of process.
I guess in order to do that, though, you initially have to have some sort of baseline to say, what is it you're trying to achieve? Why? And what is the evidence to say that's something that you should be focusing on?
Yeah, but how difficult is that to have, for example, a clear sense of time has stopped and we can take a clear assessment of what's going on now and what's going on later without all the other things going on, whether that be internal kind of contextual factors or external ones. And I mean, ideally, what you'd want is to also have some sort of control organization, which is exactly the same, but doesn't do this sort of training or doesn't do this. And it's just you can't actually do that. We have to go based on what evidence is appropriate and reasonable for us to collect. And I guess that is the interesting thing around particularly my role, where I kind of have two hats in terms of academic and also practitioner. Because as an academic, obviously, I'd love to control all these things and create some sort of perfect comparison, which could really articulate kind of outcomes such as return on investment. But in actuality, it's getting an appropriate balance of, is it robust enough that I can say as an academic that is a worthwhile and meaningful assessment of the intervention or of the change? And then as a practitioner, is this something that will work for that organization?
And is it meaningful enough? Again, if I take it back to the employee engagement space, there's a lot of organizations that will do pulse surveys with a sample population. You know, at what point does an organization say that sample is representative of an organization? I mean, again, how does an organization go about deciding? Is there a way? Is there a mechanism that one would try and do that?
I'm not sure. That's a tricky one. It also depends on how many they survey. There's a lot of talk around kind of statistical significance and power in kind of research methods spaces. But I think you have to be able to capture data on a meaningful number of people to be able to draw meaningful conclusions about the wider population. After that, I'd say the other thing to consider is the quality of measurement. So these pulse surveys, they seem very exciting, they seem quite spontaneous, and they seem to want to try and get a sense of what's going on right now. But the issue with that is often without the forethought of wanting to question the right things or to look at the right sort of focus, that also is where they fall down. So the combination of not asking enough people or not getting enough engagement from the population you're interested in, and then also the somewhat compromised measurement qualities or the somewhat compromised kind of real specificity or detail in measurement because it's done quickly. And that's not to say things done quickly can't be done well, but pulse surveys traditionally are a very, very kind of quick and dirty snapshot of something. And that might be useful depending on what you want to use that data for. If you want to do some sort of knee-jerk organizational response, that might be quite useful. Long term, quite possibly not.
No, and so we have. I haven't primed you with this. You know, you and I, when we were organizing the podcast, I didn't say, Tom, it would be really good if you could say this. I am absolutely aligned with you on this. One of my bugbears with the employee engagement surveys is it's a snapshot of an emotional state. How people carry on feeling like that. How do we know that's representative of how people generally feel? That's the first issue. Yeah. And the second issue is, how do we know the questions we're asking are the right questions? They're off the shelf questions usually. And how do we know these are the issues on the minds of the employees? Because they can only answer the question being asked. Yeah. What is it we're not asking that they really want to answer?
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's a number of factors there that I think I'm fully aligned on you with that, with regards to that side of it. So let's say we one of the things I'm a real advocate for is because we can't control, there's so much we can't control in an organization, is looking at triangulation. Whether it's taking exit interview data, whether it's taking the pulse survey data, whether it's then taking performance related data, trying to triangulate to say, what's the story going on here? Do you see any merit in that in organizations?
Yeah, that harks back to what I was saying in terms of evidence-based practice, in terms of looking at data from a variety of different sources. It's unlikely that if you collect data from a variety of different ways, like you've just suggested, and they all attempt to suggest the same sort of thing, it's unlikely you're going to be on the wrong path. With one specific type of data, you can make mistakes. There can be errors, there can be biases in the way you can interpret things. If you get a range of data and they say pretty much the same thing or might indicate that, for example, that people might be a little bit emotionally worked up because of a certain initiative or a certain thing is going on contextually, that's going to show up in the data. And that hopefully would show up in all the different types of data. Triangulation itself is one of the best ways we can summarize and synthesize evidence to inform practice. So definitely some value in there. But the other thing to acknowledge is that if all of those measures are bad, it doesn't matter, because that's never going to tell you a useful result. Even if they differ in quality, that's fine. But to try and draw conclusions based on lots of different data points, which are either poorly captured because they're asking the wrong questions or they don't actually relate to the specific thing they're interested in, then yeah, that can be quite problematic and can actually give you false confidence to want you to do something or to think in a certain way where actually the reality is quite different.
So it's important, I guess, as organizations that we whilst we see these processes as mundane things that we need to carry out, they could be sources of really high quality data, such as exit interviews, doing them in a really robust fashion, performance reviews, employee engagement surveys. The tighter and the better quality we can make them, the more then they can help drive towards a better conclusion once we triangulate data.
Absolutely. Data is, and information is power, it's useful. And the more we have, the better decisions we can make.
So you mentioned slightly earlier about biases. I've been in situations where we've triangulated, this is the work we've always done, you know, I'm a real advocate for data, and I love telling stories from data. But that in itself, I find often isn't enough, because when I get into boardrooms, I still come across individuals who will, I guess, resist what the data is telling them because they've honed in on a certain aspect. And you mentioned biases. You can start to see clear biases in when you're presenting the data. How do we try and mitigate some of that? Because, you know, the risk is it's he or she who shouts loudest, and suddenly before you know it, the data's meaningless has no relevance because now someone's gone off in a tangent and we're now forging a path down something where you're thinking, stop, that's wrong.
Biases are problematic in so many ways because you can even be misled in thinking that data in of itself doesn't have any values or things attached to it. For example, data on breakdown of ethnicity of certain types of workers, that in of itself, that data has been collected in an environment that is potentially structurally racist. And so to kind of break away the values and the kind of scope of what's going on, the context away from the data is just impossible. And so in addition to that, so the data in of itself could be biased by the sense of any kind of ongoing structural issues. And then we also have the interpretation. And clearly, often we collect lots of data. We try and pick the bits that we like that tell the story that we want it to. And then we go, ta-da, the thing we wanted to works. Or, you know, the thing, oh, this was completely expected or unanticipated. And this is a kind of funny thing about the way we interpret data is just there are so many ways in which we can draw misleading, poor, or otherwise confusing or kind of simple conclusions from actually quite complex data. So one thing I like to think of often is kind of we like to accept things that conform to what we believe and what we think. If we think a certain political party is a good party, then we are likely to embrace, accept, and talk positively about all sorts of things that they do, even if we perhaps in without the context of the politics might have agreed or disagreed with. And we can do that, for example, when reading newspapers. We turn to the pages of the articles we like because that reinforces that what we believe and what we think is a good thing. And I think there's so many ways in which we can do that with data in organisations that can lead us to misleading conclusions. For example, if I've just developed some sort of intervention and I've just had a look at the data evaluating it, I'm making an interpretation as to whether I think the intervention's been valuable. That interpretation is mine, and if I have some sort of vested interest, well, it's likely that it's going to look positive. And it's so hard to separate all these different things. So the contextual biases within the data itself and what it tells us, and then also our interpretation of that. So many biases.
So, Tom, we haven't got a hope. How do we get through this? Because if you're sat in a boardroom with data being presented to you, at some point as leaders of an organization, you've got to make a decision one way or another. How do we navigate our way through this world?
Wouldn't that be a wonderful thing to know? I think definitely it is about looking at data in context. It is also about, for example, separating the data from the interpretations where relevant. So some things are more flexibly interpreted than others. And so I think if, for example, there is a lot of scope for interpretation as to whether something is meaningful or big or small, then I think definitely getting somebody else external to provide comment and say, if I'd have done this and this is the result I would have got, this is how I would have interpreted it. And it's normally a more moderate response than perhaps the extremes of, oh, no, it's the worst thing to do or it's perhaps the best thing to do. I normally find when, for example, I take data to colleagues to say, how would you have talked about this? So this is the outcome I've got from some sort of intervention or this is the response I've got from some training. Would you consider that a good one? And obviously that's an incredibly subjective judgment. But when you get the thoughts of lots of people who are well educated in interpreting that sort of data and also are external to the outcome. So perhaps people who don't care whether they say something critical about it or positive about it, they have no vested interest. And I think that conflict of interest, separating that from the interpretation of the data can be useful. In terms of how you then make the eventual decision, my view would be that you see that particular data as only part of informing that decision. And when you take lots of different sources of evidence, you're more likely to make a robust judgment upon that. And so perhaps if the conclusion or the decision you want to make is so dependent upon the data, you're not sure how to interpret or could be interpreted other ways, you possibly need more data.
I found when we're presenting data back, just facilitating the session to say, here's what we're finding what might be driving that. And actually, when a collective are then sat there questioning that rather than having a vested interest, they're looking at what might be driving it, you tend to get more outputs of the reasons behind it rather than having the vested interest. Because you're right, that, you know, if I look bad, then you look good. And, you know, that goes on in a boardroom all the time. And therefore, we become defensive about some aspects of data. Tom, so as leaders and managers, then, how do we, because one of the challenges we have is we're in a really sort of high period of high uncertainty. We, despite all the data we can probably gather now, we don't know where to go, you know, and employees are almost aware that leaders don't have a roadmap. You know, we're the people we look to for a solution, the people we look to for direction, you know, the clues in the title, directors, don't know the sense of where we should be going. How would leaders go about now trying to get through this? Because the risk is that we don't want to be seen to be unknowledgeable or just inadequate in some way, but yet that's what it feels like as leaders might feel inadequate. How might we go about, again, getting through this without the data that we have, you know, that would inform us?
Yeah, there's a number of conflicting factors to consider there. For me, for example, in times of crisis or uncertainty, leadership is definitely what you need. That will differentiate a positive response from a negative one. How that leader then becomes an authentic driver of whatever decisions have been implemented or deciding, that is a more complex one. The one thing perhaps to consider is the interpersonal skills and qualities of that leader in terms of the confidence they have to be able to say, this might not be the right decision, but I'm going to go with it. This is the best we can do. And so that sort of accepting that there is uncertainty, that we don't know enough. I'm sure we can all come up with several recent examples of things which have thrown businesses into quite a lot of uncertainty. There is no clear sense of how to respond to that often. And so that's often a case of, let's have a look at lots of different sources of evidence. Let's kind of take a critical look at what best seems to fit our context and what seems to be best for us in this particular setting. And having the confidence to be able to say, come along with me on this journey. I know there's a lot of uncertainty. I'm going to try and attempt to do this. I think it's going to be good for us. And we'll keep reassessing that decision as and when we go through it. But follow me, come with me through this, and we'll make it out the other side. And so that sense of confidence and reassurance, I think, is definitely key. But it's also the sense of acknowledging, appreciating, and if anything, being very explicit, the fact that there is no clear direction to take. There is no clear response, some easy fix that will make things go back to normal or feel normal. We just have to go with the satisficing. Let's get all the data we can and make the best decision we possibly can. And if that's the wrong one, then we did our best with what we could at the time. I think that's all you can do.
Yeah, completely. And I guess it's also making sure that you're involving people on the journey so that it's to say, because I don't have all the answers, it's almost a hypothesis to say, here's what we think might happen, let's see. And then being able to adjust and adapt according to the outcomes of whatever you see. It's almost this emergent strategy that the more you see, the more then you respond accordingly.
Yeah, and it's worth noting that for me, leadership isn't really the important factor in this. It's followership. It's getting people to come along with you in that journey. And that is going to be what's important in terms of creating that social identity for you as a team, as a group, as an organization, to be able to say, this is where we're going and this is us doing our best with it.
So social identity, I'm fascinated with that area, because one of the things that leaders can do in this time of crisis and uncertainty is to say, let's build this cohesiveness of not them and us, but us as a collective.
Yes.
That we are all involved, we're going to discover and explore together. But also, and I use this analogy a lot from my pharmacy days, is if you take a cell, you know, a human cell, and the more receptors it has on the outside, the more it can respond to its environment. We're almost doing that by involving people more to say, let's to collectively try and deliver this strategy and get through this.
Yeah, and I mean, the particular thing to note here is if it's massive uncertainty, people are going to be looking for that sense of identity and that sense of leader that will, in wherever way possible, minimize that. So if you're unsure of what your job's going to look like next week, you're going to want that leader who provides a clear sense of this is who we are and this is how we're going to make it through together. So, yeah, a complex situation. Identity definitely for me has a massive part in reducing that uncertainty and also appreciating it and acknowledging it.
So, and then there's the other bit, which is I think the values is having that cohesiveness of here's who we are and here's how we get things done around here, and combining your purpose with your values, the identity with the values of the organization. So even in times of where we don't have enough data, or we don't not sure if it's the high quality data that we would love to have, actually it's being able to coalesce around that identity and values to say this is who we are, this is how we operate, and therefore the how we operate will help dictate which way the strategy needs to go, knowing we don't have all the answers. So beautiful.
Absolutely. And as you say, making the best of the people on that journey. So being consultative in that decision making style has to be important in driving people's sense of control and ownership over uncertainty. Yeah.
Tom, I love your curiosity. You've done various papers into, you know, humor and decision making and change and positive feedback and all sorts of other things. What's the one piece of research that you've read that you've just thought, wow, that's really, really interesting, that you can just off the top of your head think about, that you think, what is that?
Okay. Oh, this is, yeah, okay. Okay. I would go, so there's a paper called, I think it's A Manifesto for Psychological Science. And it breaks down all the different aspects of what we do in the normal research cycle. So it would be collect some information, make a hypothesis based on theory and evidence, design a study, collect data, interpret that data, and then feed back into our understanding. And what it so elegantly does is it breaks down all those different steps and shows us here are where the biases are, here are where the issues are, here is why we perhaps can't be as trusting of evidence as we think we might. So there are a number of different things, harking back to the biases we've talked about, in terms of parts of the process which can be inherently manipulated, twisted, and that might undermine our understanding or our confidence in science. So a good example is what's known as p-hacking, which is choosing which bits of data to present or changing bits of decision-making around data to make sure it tells you that the thing you did was great and was exactly as expected. And we all do that, for example, in organizations. When we look at interventions, we might have 10 different outcomes that we expect to be changed. If 6 of those are positive, when we've actually done that intervention, we go, yes, outcomes for these 6 things have gone up, great. And we don't talk about those other 4, do we? We just forget about those and hope those go under the carpet, forgetting people were ever interested in them. And so this article for me breaks down all these different steps. And so whether it was hypothesizing after we know our results, what's known as harking, or kind of manipulating the situation, or even part of the research cycle, which is publication, where we know that if you have a significant, positive, big effect, something that looks juicy and novel, it's far more likely to be published, which means then you've got a state of literature which might exaggerate the impact of, for example, a workplace intervention far beyond the evidence that would support it. And so I'm particularly interested, as you say, that curiosity of, well, to what extent does this actually matter? So if all evidence is poor, then evidence-based practice can continue as normal. We just look at all the sources of evidence. But in fact, if there are these sorts of biases and issues all throughout the literature, then how do we negotiate that to work out what is the good evidence that we should be applying and that we can trust, and what's the poor evidence that we should be dismissing and being critical of?
So remind me, what was that article called again?
I think it was A Manifesto for Psychological Science.
Okay, I'm going to try and look out for that. That sounds fascinating. Tom, that's all we've got time for today. I want to thank you for sharing your insights, all of your experience, your expertise, and your fascination with this whole area, your curiosity, really resonates with me, and I genuinely could talk to you all day. So thank you very much for sharing your insights today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been good fun.
Fantastic. So thanks very much, Tom. That's Dr. Thomas Evans talking to us today about evidence-based practice and his curious mind that sort of leads him to explore all of these areas. Fascinating. And I'm sure we're all going to look at that paper that he mentioned. So thanks very much. That's all from me today. Amrit Sander from The Engagement Coach. I will see you soon. Take care.
The Engagement Coach Podcast.